Our guest tonight, a very special and distinguished presence who is gracing this town for a day or two, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, is the author of the new book, Infidel. One would say instantly to give your credentials that you are a former member of the Parliament of Holland.
Yes.
Though you were, of course, born in Somalia.
Yes, I'm born in Somalia. I grew up in Somalia, Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, and Kenya, and the Netherlands, and I became a member of parliament in Holland between 2003 and 2006, and I now live in the United States.
It is a fabulous story, as given in your new book, Infidel, but one must instantly examine whether your book is accurately titled. An infidel, and you are, of course, Muslim in background, and you consider yourself in some ways an atheist now, or an agnostic, and detached from Islam, which once gave a good deal of meaning and structure to your life. In Islamic terms, an infidel is one who has never had the grace or the good fortune to learn the truth as given by the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
Yes.
I'm an infidel.
Yes.
Because I've never been a Muslim, but you are.
An apostate. Yes. I thought of calling the book an apostate.
Yeah.
And then I thought that that was, I don't know, something, a position in purgatory perhaps. I was always put in with the infidels. I would say, let's look at our religion. Let's examine the moral guidance of the Prophet Muhammad. Let's say that the Prophet, let's accept that the Quran is not written by God himself, but by human beings, because that will give us the opportunity to change it. And then my fellow Muslims would cry, infidel, you've been influenced by the infidels.
Of course, in Christianity, or in Judaism, you can say that as well. You can, if you're a liberal Christian, or a liberal or reformed Jew, you can say, well, the Old Testament, or the New Testament, the Hebrew Bible, or the New Testament, they're not literally dictated by God, as some of our fundamentalist colleagues would say, but still there is much that is godly and much that is of deep spiritual truth to be found in those volumes.
Yes.
You can't say that in Islam?
Not yet. It will come. Islam is the youngest brother of the three mm-hmm. monotheistic religions. Judaism and the Jews and the Christians have gone through a long process of reformation and enlightenment and soul searching.
But haven't there been reform movements within Islam historically?
Yes, historically there have been reform movements, individuals who have said we need to adapt to the reality of today as opposed to the reality of the 7th and 8th centuries. Mm-hmm. But they've always been exiled, killed, shunned. And at one point, I think in the 9th century, people said we are going to close literally the gates of reason, and thus we remained stagnant in that moment.
We will close the gates of reason.
Yes, yes, because questioning and critical thinking and curiosity and rationality were seen to be a threat to the foundations of Islam. So those people who wanted to think, those Muslims at that time in the 9th century, 10th century, who wanted to go ahead, were seen, considered to be infidels or apostates.
Now, Ayaan, surely there are some Muslim intellectuals, whether in Cairo or, for that matter, in Amsterdam or in London, who would disagree with you, who would say, no, 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 there's room for reason, there's room for rational discourse. That's what theologians do. They do rational discourse around what we know about God.
Yes. I think that we would then be confusing a few things. Of course, there is within Islam, and even within the Quran, and within the teachings of the Prophet, what the Prophet Muhammad left, there is room to maneuver, to think.
Mm-hmm.
But Muslims do not allow it, either by being complacent and standing by as critical thinkers are taken away and killed and exiled and shunned, or by literally, and that's a minority, taking weapons up against them. At this point, you will not see any Christian or any Jewish person who wants to question his or her religion being threatened and killed in our day. And in within Islam, that is the case still in the 21st century.
I want to come to a crucial date in the 21st century, in fact. November 2nd, 2004. It's a day that changed your life totally.
Absolutely.
What happened?
Theo van Gogh, who helped me make a film called Submission about women, was killed on the streets of Amsterdam.
Who was Theo van Gogh?
Theo van Gogh is a grandson of Vincent van Gogh.
The brother of?
The great Dutch painter, yes.
Yeah.
He was, a grandchild of the brother of Vincent van Gogh.
Yeah. Who was also Theo?
Who was also Theo,
yeah.
Yes. And he's from the Theo branch, not from the Vincent
right.
branch. And he helped me. He was a bit of a maverick. He would provoke everyone. He provoked especially the Jewish community. He had provoked everyone in Holland. And he used to call himself the village idiot. And he had said and written books on Islam, very critical. But then after he helped me with the film, a young Moroccan man went after him, accosted him on the street, 8:45 a.m. in the morning as he cycled to his work, shot him, tried to cut off his head, and then left a letter in his body for me.
Yes, pinned down with a knife into the body of Theo van Gogh.
Yes.
And the letter was the message that you were next on the list. They were going to kill you.
Yes. And worse than that, the only reason that they got to Theo van Gogh first was because Theo had no protection and I had protection.
No. Now, what was in that film, Submission?
Submission is about, you will see four women with verses from the Holy Quran written on their bodies. The idea is that growing up as a Muslim woman, I learned that there's only one relation possible to my God, Allah, and that is a relationship of submission. What I wanted to do in the film was shift that concept of God from submission to one of dialogue. So I have four women talking to God and telling him, God, I submit my will to you. And they have the Quranic verse that says, flog the adulterer or wear the veil or a disobedient wife should be beaten or you have to be ready for your husband at all times. All these verses from the Quran written on their bodies.
What
saying,
you find most immediately offensive in Islam, and you were once a devout Muslim, I know that.
Yes.
As a younger woman. You're now, what, about 38 or thereabouts?
37.
37. But when you were a girl of, if you go back 20 years, when you were 17,
yes.
You were a devout Muslim woman. You were wearing the veil, the hijab, I think. Were you
yes,
not?
Yes.
Living in Kenya at the time.
Yes.
And much taken with the Muslim Brotherhood, which...
Yes.
Originated in Egypt, it was spreading all over
yes.
the world, and is in some ways the base for modern jihadism.
Yes, and perhaps for the reformation that is about to start, because the Muslim Brotherhood, you can say whatever you want to say of it, but they force you to read the Quran, not just learn it by heart.
Mm-hmm.
And because I was made to read the Quran and understand its meaning, that had me thinking and asking questions.
And what you find most offensive in the Quran and in Islamic practice is what seems to be dictated about the rights, or rather the lack of rights for women and the ways in which women may be and should be treated.
Yes. As a woman, I am to obey my husband indefinitely. It is not reciprocal. I can be divorced if my husband tells me three times in
yeah.
the presence of two witnesses, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. I can't do the same. My testimony is worth half of only that of one man. I have to prove if I am raped that the rapist has done it. I have to bring about four witnesses to do that. There are so many injustices against women, and each verse ends with Allah is just, Allah is all-knowing, Allah is omniscient. And so that I find that outrageous.
You also were quite concerned with the fact that Muslim men, rather routinely, at least the ones that you know about, among the Somalis living in the Netherlands, for example, but elsewhere in the world as well, Muslim men tend to beat up their wives rather often, you say.
Yes, the Muslim Brotherhood brought up about a culture in which women are supposed to obey their husbands, and if you don't, then he has a right to beat you. Now, I think long ago, in my grandmother's time, the opportunity to beat a woman would not occur often, because the woman knew had her role and the man had his role. But in urban cities, that has changed now. Also, when men get frustrated, they go about beating their wives and then say, she disobeyed me. And what I found most frightening and really striking was that women I translated for who had the opportunity to leave these areas of domestic violence would say, I can't leave, I have to obey because I'm afraid of the hereafter. God will probably put me in hell. So they would go back to a situation of abuse for fear that they might go to hell.
Yet one other theme which figures significantly in your development of your critical attitude towards Islam and towards Islamic culture, and which figures also in your own life, is the theme of, one has to confront it directly, genital mutilation, sometimes called female circumcision, but also called mutilation.
Yes. Female genital mutilation is a tradition that was in practice before Islam was founded, and within societies that are not Islamic at all. But there's one thing that's very interesting about that. By removing the clitoris and sewing together the labia, the opening of the vagina, you ensure that the girl remains a virgin. And one of the, no, perhaps the most important emphasis on sexuality within Islam is that there's no premarital sex, and that is regulated through the woman. So what you now see is that even though female genital mutilation has been eradicated in most un-Islamic societies, it is prevalent within Islamic societies because of that emphasis on virginity.
And is so it possibly more prevalent in Islamic societies in Africa than in the Middle East?
No, it's not. It is prevalent in Yemen, in Oman, in Iraq. It's been now transported to Indonesia, where, and in Indonesia, there was no history of female genital mutilation in parts of Saudi Arabia. But because these are closed societies, all you have are limited reports. And the emphasis that's put on the female genital, what theologians will tell, it's not in the Quran, it's not in the Hadith, but imams propagate it as Islamic because they lay emphasis on controlling the sexuality of women.
There are some listeners right now who are stunned to hear this. They've never really heard about it before. And also they're wondering, and I'm putting myself in their position, if you sew up the labia, we have to talk about elementary anatomy here, so as to keep a woman chaste until she's married, well, what happens when she gets married?
Well, what happens is, depending on how bad the mutilation is, that either a doctor is called in if you're living in an urban society and you have a lot of money and you are enlightened enough to call a doctor, that then the opening of the vagina is, or what was the opening is then open.
It's surgically restored.
Surgically restored.
Yeah.
And when in primitive circumstances, and you have to realize that there are 140 million women who are mutilated, that sometimes the husbands themselves will try and open it with a knife, with a piece of glass, with a razor blade, with scissors. And in the process, some women get infected, get AIDS, bleed to death.
There must be a high mortality rate on the basis of this practice.
According to the United Nations, it's much worse than the AIDS figures.
Yeah. Shocking.
It's shocking. It's appalling, and it is man-made. It's a man-made catastrophe. And with the HIV virus, at least you can say it has natural causes. But in this case, all these little girls, every 10 minutes, a girl is circumcised.
If you went to a major imam in London, say, perhaps of Pakistani origin, and running a significant mosque in London, thus in the Western world, and you said to him, this is a very evil practice, and it should not be done by anybody, and it need not be done to be a devout Muslim, what would he say?
I think most of them will say, let's look at the Quran, let's look at the Hadith. It's not noted there, so I might persuade them to say, let's not do it.
Mm-hmm.
But growing up in Somalia and in Kenya, where there are various Muslims, including Muslims from Pakistan, at the age when girls get to puberty, and because these are taboo on sexuality and on premarital sex, then when girls are seen to have boyfriends, when they're seen to be developing themselves sexually, suddenly people start to say she must stay in the house, or then resort to female genital mutilation, because that's a way of curbing the sexuality.
It's a delicate matter, and I wouldn't touch upon it, except that you write about it in this stunning new book of yours, Infidel. But you reveal that this was done to you when you were 5 years old.
Yes, and out of love. My grandmother believed that if she did not do that, that my sister and I would not find husbands. She believed that we would be shunned. And by the way, even at that age, attending madrasa, Quran school, there was a little girl who was an orphan, who was not at the age of 8, who had not been mutilated yet. We call it cleansing, who had not been cleansed. And she was the object of abuse. She was bullied. No other children wanted to play with her. She was spat upon. They would pull her hair. And I didn't want to be like that. So at the age of 5, I agreed with my grandmother that it had to happen because I didn't want to be shunned. So it is, and it's celebrated. And I knew no better until I came among people who did not practice it.
There are others who know better and who are very much concerned with the rights of women. They are sometimes called feminists. And there are loads of those in the Western world, including in Holland. And one wonders why there's been so little response from feminist organizations to this rather dreadful practice, and more broadly, why there's not been feminist concern for the rights of women, whether Islamic or otherwise, but specifically for Islamic women who are very often getting banged up, that is, mistreated, knocked around by their husbands, who are denied full education, and who indeed have had this worked on them earlier in their lives, that is the genital mutilation, or are required to acknowledge and allow that to be done to their own daughters. We need to talk about why their Western response to these dysfunctional aspects of what might broadly be called Islamic culture, as that Islamic culture is now located in and flourishing in the Western world.
Yes.
We return directly to Ayan Hirsi Ali, author of Infidel, after we pause for this. And we return to Ayan Hirsi Ali, drawing from her stunning new book, Infidel. About that book, various significant authors have had very appreciative things to say. Interestingly, one of them is Salman Rushdie,
yes,
who had a fatwa declared on him many years ago. That is essentially an order to kill him, given actually by the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran. Salman Rushdie says this is an immensely important book. Actually, he's saying this about your last book, but it holds for this one as well. This is an immensely important book, passionate, challenging, and necessary. It should be read as widely as possible because it tells the truth, the unvarnished, uncomfortable truth. You know, I can't resist telling you that Rushdie was here 2 or 3 times on this program. The first time he came with a number of guards. A few other people have come here with guards. One of them was Margaret Thatcher. And she came with a rather large contingent, both from New Scotland Yard and local police. I have to note that you are here with some protection as well. You travel that way, do you?
Yes, I do. I live that way for since 2002.
What's
since
the why? Simply why?
Because there might be an individual somewhere who thinks that because I've become an apostate, by killing me, he or she will go to heaven and probably get 72 virgins and so on.
Just as that fellow thought, that native-born Dutchman of Moroccan descent, when he killed your colleague Theo van Gogh.
Yes, and he explained in court when he got the opportunity to speak that it had nothing to do with being a Moroccan or with being an immigrant, that he said, it's my religion, it's a command from God, and that even if it was his own brother, he would do it. And he emphasized that he was not offended by any of the, insults that Theo van Gogh had expressed towards Moroccans. But he felt that he had to follow the command of God.
You are very active in saying what you think, writing what you think. You've written a very strong critique, really, of Islam itself. Earlier in various articles, and now in this book, this memoir of yours, Infidel. Does it then follow that you are essentially going to be under this sort of threat for the rest of your life?
Well, not necessarily for the rest of my life, but as long as there are young men and young women walking around who think that by killing me, they will be rewarded in heaven by God. As long as that is the case, then I need to have protection because I love life and I want to live.
I would hope so. Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Let me come back to the question I was raising just before we stopped for commercials. Feminists, multiculturalists, liberals generally, of the Western variety in Western Europe, or for that matter in this country, will certainly be somewhat critical of the point of view you're representing now, particularly because they think that one has to honor all cultures. And if cultures shift and establish residence within our own culture, we have to be hospitable to them and to understand that there are differences between various worldviews, Weltanschauungen,
yes.
And they are coordinated perhaps with different religions and with different customs, even tribal customs. And let 1,000 flowers bloom, and let 100 cultures function equally well in Amsterdam or in Chicago.
Well, I wish that could be the case. My stance is that human beings are equal. Muslims and non-Muslims are equal. Blacks and whites are equal. Men and women are equal. Homosexuals and heterosexuals are equal. But cultures are not equal.
You mean there are better and lesser cultures?
Yes. I come from a tribal culture. Islam was founded in an Arab desert tribal culture, and all sorts of characteristics of that culture have been elevated to divine law, to divine rule.
Your father is in fact designated by one or another journalist whom I read in preparation for this program as a former Somalian warlord. Is that accurate?
No, he was not a warlord. He had gotten part of his education here in the United States. He was fascinated by America and the American dream and American pioneership, and he wanted Somalia to become like the United States. And he failed in that, or at least he thought he failed in that. And what I have come as his daughter is come in 1992 to Holland, take part in a society that is no longer tribal, but is made up of citizens. And that transition, that journey from tribal life to citizenship and to the social contract, that I think is something that feminists and other people who need to understand it here in the West have neglected to understand. And if only they could see, and if only they could take note of how in tribal societies women and children are oppressed, they would not allow themselves to be blackmailed into defending beliefs such as the Islamic belief that make this subjugation of women legitimate and permanent.
Now, for some 4 years, you were a member of the lower house of the Dutch parliament.
Yes.
Elected.
Yes.
Which was a startling development of your life in itself. That's only 6 years after you came to Holland. You're in the ruling elite, so to speak. And on the floor of the parliamentary body, surely you must have spoken critically about what was happening in some of these communities in Holland. How did your parliamentary colleagues respond to what you were saying?
They responded, some of them responded, like my party, the Liberal Party, who said, we want to put you on the list to address these issues because other members of parliament will be called white imperialists, middle-aged men. They don't understand it. You've been through it. You have a voice. You represent and so on. The Social Democrats, unfortunately, whose existence is based on defending the rights of the underdog, said...
This is the Socialist Party, in essence, of Holland.
Yes, the Social Democrats.
Yeah.
They would say, no, we have to emancipate the entire group first before we come to women, and we must respect, just like the Christian Democrats would say...
So if they want to do genital mutilation on their pre-adolescent daughters, it's their right.
Well, they wouldn't say it that hard, but they would be very embarrassed about it. They would just say, let's address that later.
Let's look otherwise.
Yes.
Look otherwise.
Look otherwise.
Yeah.
Which to me really made me remember everything will be fine in the hereafter.
Mm-hmm.
Allow yourself as a woman to be beaten, be obedient, deny yourself life, liberty, and the pursuit mm-hmm. of happiness because you'll be rewarded in the hereafter. So this was a sort of secular hereafter.
More anon. We need to continue our discussion of this in relation to your own life story, which is a startling life story. And we will return directly to Ayan Hirsi Ali, drawing from her book Infidel, after a quick stop in the newsroom, and we return to Ayan Hirsi Ali. Let's return just a bit to your own life story. I've kind of quickly glided over this rather tremendous and startling transformation. You came there essentially seeking refuge from trouble in your own homeland. In fact, you lied a little bit, as appeared later on. Actually, you came there from Germany, but you said you had come directly from Somalia.
Yes.
And you had been resident in Kenya, but you said you had been resident in Somalia. Somalia was in a great state of civil war, and so you could claim a sort of refugee status on that basis. But if you certified that you had just come from Somalia, which in fact you hadn't done, but Somalia was your home country. But you did get into Holland, and later on you made clear in television interviews that you had falsified some of the detail a bit, and that was caused some stir in Parliament, actually, but ultimately it worked out with a recertification of your citizenship rights in the Netherlands. I know all that. But how does one go from an immigrant girl who hasn't even had a full college education when she arrives in the Netherlands to a member of Parliament?
How does one go from that to that? I explain in the book in complete detail, yes. I took political science in 1995 because I wanted to understand why people like me, mostly from Muslim countries. And as Muslims, we were taught that we were superior, and we had a superior recipe for life. Why we were flooding into Western countries, into infidel land, and why there was so much war and turmoil, and where in Holland and in the other European countries, why there was so much peace and prosperity and calm. And
why things weren't working to the advantage of ordinary citizens in the Islamic world, but were working better for ordinary citizens in this case, Western Europe.
In Western Europe and in the West.
Yeah.
And in those 5 years, I learned that what I was seeing in Western Europe, in the West, was not really something that was always there. It was an outcome of a long struggle, and that Europe and the West had known their bloody moments. I had learned about the Holocaust, I had learned about the history of colonialism, the history of wars and alliances,
sure,
and all the terrible,
yeah,
things that had happened. And one thing that kept on recurring was that there was this, there was secularism. As Muslims, we always tended, or as tribes, we always tended to revert back to, this is how my forefathers used to do things. And so for us to get a solution to our conflict, we imitated again and again our forefathers, whether it was only tribal, traditional, or whether it was Islamic. Now, I had accepted those answers and went to work for a Labour Social Democratic Party think tank. And I was working there for 1 week, and then the 11th of September had taken place.
Uh-huh.
And like everyone else, of course, I was shocked, except that being a Muslim at that time, I found myself in a very special position in which, on the one hand, Western leaders were appealing to us as Muslims, please stand up and say this is not done in the name of my religion. And the likes of bin Laden were on the other side and saying, stand up, we're at war against the West, and fight along. And
until 9/11, you were essentially, and you would describe yourself as having been essentially still a loyal Muslim.
Yes, not practicing, but a loyal Muslim. I had, as I explained in the book, kind of developed a small shutter in my mind where I would just not want to think about the inconsistencies between the way I live and the scriptures.
You would lock them into that special part of your brain.
Yes.
Or your mind. Yes.
Yes. And I got away with it as long as there were no reminders. If I mixed with Somalis or with other Muslims who would tell me, stop drinking wine, cover your hair, give up your relationship with your boyfriend, then I would get into trouble. But as long as I avoided them, no one would remind me of that. And I somehow reconciled myself. And I think there are thousands of Muslims who live like that today in Europe. And it's the 11th of September that that changed. And I wanted to, I had a problem of conscience. And it was a problem with what is in the Quran, as cited by bin Laden, because I looked it up, what he was saying. And I discovered that there was a major problem with the religion of my parents, that I was born.
But what are the particular surah, or in the Quran, or for that matter, what are the sayings in the Hadith, which is the other major source of sacred lore for Muslims. What are some of the particular items of content that you find especially unacceptable?
The relationship to infidels, that is, either convert them or kill them.
Does it really say that?
Yes. Wait for them, convert them, and if they disagree, ambush them and kill them. There is, if I had not learned about the Holocaust, which I only discovered when I was 24, if you look at the amount of verses and hadith that are anti-Jewish and hostile to Jews, you will be appalled. If you look at the number of verses regarding women saying that they are subordinate, they must obey, they are friends of Satan, they can be misled, and so on, that's appalling.
By the way, about the Holocaust, haven't you learned? We now have it on the authority of Mr. Ahmadinejad that the Holocaust, in fact, did not happen.
I think millions of people across the world, in the third world, and especially Muslims, have not learned about the Holocaust. No one has taught them. Many people there are illiterate, and most of them living under Arab Islamic dictatorships have actually been indoctrinated to long for a Holocaust. So that history is very complicated. But
about 9/11, similar matter. Despite the fact that Bin Laden took credit for it, finally, it's a common idea in the Islamic world that those weren't Muslims on those planes. They were Jews and Christians, probably, and the whole thing was basically a Jewish plot. Unless it was a plot run by the American government.
Yeah, and so on and so forth. So I grew up with these idiotic...
Those ideas are widely held in the Muslim world today, are they?
Yes, they
are. About 9/11.
Yes. And when you have populations living in closed societies under dictatorships, they can actually be groomed into thinking this from childhood. The media that we get through the Quran, through the Imams, it's everything. All your problems have been caused by Jews. And as long as the populations believe this, then they allow themselves to be subjugated by these dictators on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's an easy and comfortable way to blame external factors.
But look, now I must, in a way, defend Islam, or at least raise some questions.
Do that, please.
A basic question I would raise, and in this I'm standing in for Muslim listeners who are ready to ask this question themselves. No, 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 they would have to say, that is not true about Jews and Christians in the Muslim world. For example, we have the whole tradition of dhimmitude. Christians and Jews are dhimmi. They are people of the book, but they are not as close to the full revealed truth as those who have learned from the Prophet, peace be upon him. But still, though they may have to pay more taxes in classical Islamic culture, they may have some reduction in their civic rights, so to speak, they are to be tolerated as dhimmi.
Yes, and my position since 9/11 is Islam as a belief system is incompatible with liberal democracy, because within liberal democracy, we don't know of a concept called dhimmis, and relegating people into positions that are lower than other positions, than, you know, the main. And so the whole dhimmi story, once upon a time, it might have been sufficient for Jews and for Christians to be in that position as minorities. But living in liberal democracies, or living in the world we live in today, with the United Nations and the Declaration of Human Rights, I think that you can no longer defend the position of dhimmi. You can no longer say we are going to accept Jews only as dhimmis or exterminate them. And that is what the Islamic Brotherhood is defending.
Now, there is a basic question that does arise. I mean to pose it right now, even as we pause once again for some commercials. Then I would hope we can address it afterwards. There's a phenomenon which has been noted by many social observers, even by people in my own profession, social psychologists and sociologists, and that is that in the Western world, where you have large groupings of Muslims from whatever country, whether they're Arab or whether they are African, you very often tend to get greater and more ferocious full investment in severe and demanding jihadist or Wahhabist versions of Islam from the kids than you do from their parents. Even native-born, that is, native-born in England or native-born in the Netherlands, they are often more purely, regressively nativist, in, that is to say, primitivist, in their identification with the severe demands of the religion than are the parents who were the original immigrants. How does one account for that? That's the question I pose, looking forward to your response right after this.
Okay.
And we return to Ayan Hirsi Ali. We are drawing from her excellent and very important new book, Infidel. That is, by the way, just published by Free Press. The basic question I was raising a moment ago is simply, why are the young more jihadist very often in the West than their parents?
I don't have a proper explanation for that. I can share with you my experience that in 1985, my mother was an Orthodox Muslim, but not a political Muslim. She had no political notion of what Islam could be. But a young woman in our school called Sister Aziza, who had visited Medina and who herself had been indoctrinated there with political Islam, had come to us, to me, and made us aware first of what she called an inner jihad, which was all about meeting the obligations, praying the five times a day, covering yourself, being obedient and so on. So just pretty much being a nice person. And then there was the outer jihad, and that was the political part, in which the world was divided into we and they, we the Muslims, the Ummah, and they, the unbelievers, the enemy. And look, she showed us pictures of people in Iran who were killed, gassed by the Americans and the Jews. They were the enemies, and we had to hate them, and we had to fight them, and so on and so forth. And I think that right now, young people are meeting a more refined, radical, utopian, totalitarian ideology that is going by the banner of Islam that our parents and our grandparents were not exposed to.
There have been some movements, and there are some particular ideologues who can be identified as having provided the ideas. Isn't that so?
Yes, there is Hassan al-Banna.
Who was he, Hassan al-Banna?
An Egyptian man who developed or who started or founded the Islamic Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
And you had Wahhabi in Saudi Arabia, the marriage between the Saudi family and Wahhabi as...
Wahhabism is more than two centuries old, is it not?
Perhaps even less. It could be a little less.
Well, the Abdul Wahhab, who was the founder of it, is a figure in the 18th century.
He's a figure in the 18th century, but it takes off when Saudi Arabia is established. And with Hassan al-Banna's doctrine, it takes off. He starts in the 1920s, but it takes off in the 1970s, 1980s.
There's another figure who's gotten a lot of attention recently in Western attempts to reconstruct this history, this little fellow from Egypt, Qutb.
Yes.
Qutb.
Yes, who was hanged. He makes a convincing case, which is very consistent,
mm-hmm.
that if we go back to the 7th century, if we go back and follow the Prophet Muhammad as our guide and go back to the caliphate, and he puts a huge stress on the caliphate of Umar, then we will go back to the days of glory. And so there's this utopia which he paints for us.
And he also paints a very contemptuous picture of the West.
Yes.
He spent a year or so in this country, much of it at a little college out in Colorado, and seems to have been quite overwhelmed by the sexual freedom that he observed.
Yes, just like I came here and I was overwhelmed by the sexual freedom, but he just gave a different interpretation to it. The basic idea is that with this amount of sexual permissiveness, as he calls it, there's going to be fitna or chaos, and that the West is decadent because of mm-hmm. this and can easily be fought. I don't think that he does not, if you read his book and compare him to, for example, Karl Marx, you will see that Marx had more brilliant ideas. But he makes a convincing case with his simplicity. And he is only successful because what he says is very much consistent with the Quran and the Hadith.
You see this kind of Islamic radicalism, shall we call it, or this Islamic fundamentalism, strongly turned towards violence and towards actual confrontation with the non-Islamic world. You see all of this as a great force now moving in the world, and of course moving into the West, if only because we've now got large and ever-expanding Muslim populations in the Western world, particularly in Western Europe. And demographically, they are expanding very rapidly as compared to native European groups who are dwindling. They're usually demographically below replacement level.
Yes.
There's been a book recently by Mark Stein, I wonder if you know it.
I've not read the book, but I've heard of it.
And he's been on this program a few times, and it paints that picture in very, very worried terms. So this is a great movement that we now confront. What is the likely outcome of that confrontation?
It depends. If we continue to be complacent, stick our heads in the sand and pretend the whole problem will go away on its own, then I'm afraid that it's going to be a terrible scenario that might look like what the Balkans looked like a few years ago. If we wake up to it and say we have to deal with a totalitarian movement here, very much like the communist movement, very much like the Nazi ideology, mm-hmm. and because we in the West have that experience, that we can fight it by calling a spade, and trying to enlighten individuals to whom this ideology is appealing and tell them exactly what it can end in. Look at what happened in Iran in 1979. The Iranians followed Ayatollah Khomeini, and now many of them regret it and are coming here. Many of those who voluntarily went after him, if we can explain again and again to those individuals who are susceptible to it, if we in Europe try to get controlled and planned immigration, if we try to make people understand what the social contract was about, what citizenship is about, as opposed to being a member of a tribe or a clan, then we have a chance of succeeding, I think, besides, of course, the necessary and very urgent military means.
You are now located at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. One of your colleagues there, another fellow of AEI, is Michael Ledeen, whom I know a bit. And Ledeen, an American student of Iranian affairs particularly, has been arguing for some years, and one reads an op-ed by him every month or so, in which he asserts this, that there is a nascent revolution against the Shiite clerics who run Iran, that Iran is very restive at the moment and probably will go back to what it was.
I think he has a point. I don't know how fast that will go.
Yeah.
But if I, living in Holland, most of the enlightened Muslims saying let's fight for a reformation were Iranians. Most of the secular people in Europe are from Iran, here in the United States. And after 9/11, it was surprising to see that they demonstrated this time for the United States with American flags instead of banning them.
Some personal questions, just one or two before we go to the phones. When did you come to the fellowship at AEI in Washington?
September 2006.
And so this is the first time that you're resident in the United States?
Yes.
Though you've visited the U.S. before, I know.
Yes.
What impression do you have of these matters as they are handled in this country?
My superficial impression is that Americans look at Islam as a matter of foreign policy, as opposed to Europeans who see Islam as a matter of domestic policy. I think that Americans might be making a mistake because there are radical cells within the United States. There is evidence that, for example, universities and prisons are being infiltrated.
Mm-hmm.
And the largest number of there are more Muslims living in Latin America than there are in Europe. Latin America is what some people cynically call the backyard of the United States. So I would say that it would be a terrible mistake if I am right and Americans look at Islam only as a matter of foreign policy.
Yet there is some restiveness within the American Muslim community, some sense that they are being ill-treated and singled out, profiled out for special suspicion. And many American liberals are concerned about that, share that view, and want us to yield to that complaint.
It's extremely difficult to deal with that. We have to find some sort of balance between safety and safeguarding civil liberties. I think Muslims can help in that by standing up to those who want to use Islam as an instrument of terrorism. As long as Muslims don't do that, they run the risk of being singled out, because you need the next incident of terrorism to take place, and then there will be no argument. And as long as Muslims today demonstrate by taking to the streets in large numbers, demonstrating against cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad,
yes,
but remaining mm-hmm. silent when people are beheaded, and when train stations are blown up, and when attempts are made to bring down four airplanes, as we've last seen in, I think that's not going to make the case for those people who feel that they are ill-treated. It's not going to make for them the case. But I want to emphasize that throwing away civil liberties and blindly profiling people on what you think, on whom you think is Islam, is not the way out, because Islam is a set of beliefs, and what you see is that there are native people who do not look like a Pakistani or a Moroccan, who are not olive-skinned, are also converting to Islam. So it would be very simplistic of law enforcement officials to just concentrate on visible marks. It's not. Islam is a belief system, and it's what is in your head and not so much how you look like. Look at Mohammed Atta. He put on a pair of jeans and a Lacoste t-shirt and looked very much the American boy.
And they went to a strip bar or something.
Yes.
Just a night or two before.
Yes.
9/11.
Yes, and
what does one
whiskey.
Make of that?
Well, I think that just shows how determined and how cunning the extremists are willing to be to outwit law enforcement officials. So the safeguarding of civil liberties, that is something we should all defend with everything that we have, because that's what distinguishes an open society from a closed society and a dictatorship. And as long as this is not an open society, then, you know, civil liberties must be safeguarded. But I would again and again and again appeal to Muslims, just normal, ordinary Muslims who are not political at all, to come out and say, well, we don't want this to be done in the name of our religion. I'm optimistic in that, because a lot of the informants, those people who help with intelligence, are Muslims. So
I wonder if we will hear from some Muslim listeners tonight. I wouldn't be surprised that we do, and they would be welcome, of course. 591-7200 is the number. We will pause, take care of some commercials, and then we've got an open field, and we'll stay with the phones and the email for the rest of the evening. And our guest tonight, as you have learned, is Ayaan Hirsi Ali, and the new book of hers that we're drawing from, it's a very moving and very instructive memoir, is titled Infidel. That is just published by Free Press. 591-7200 is the number. One line is available at the moment. But if you're hitting the busy signal, keep trying, especially after we say goodnight to a prior caller. And with that, we go to the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I have a comment to make that, first of all, that what she's mentioning, the mutilation, is not part of Islam, and it's not found in other countries. And it's probably a local custom in Africa.
Yes, sir. I hope that was the case, but that's not the case. Look at the United Nations list of countries and the countries listed by Amnesty International, and they range from Somalia, almost 100% Muslim, and 97% genital mutilation, Eritrea, Egypt, Sudan, Yemen, Oman, parts of Iraq, Indonesia. These are all Muslim countries.
Yeah, and but it's not mentioned anywhere in Quran or in any other Islamic. It's a local custom.
I have always emphasized that it's a custom that occurred before Islam was founded, but it is a custom that is today.
It's very important to mention that it's a custom, but not part of Islam. Can you say that?
I say that. I concede to that. But if you must concede with me that because Islam lays a great emphasis on banning premarital sex, that those countries that want to ensure that a girl is a virgin on her wedding night have used female genital mutilation as an instrument to ensure that virginity is in place. So it's not in the Quran, it's not in the Sahih Sita Hadith, it's in the disputed Hadith, and that imams and theologians have defended this practice as something to
not all of them, not all of them.
Certainly not, but if I were you, sir...
Because there I'm from Pakistan, and we have not heard of such things in our culture back there, so it has to be some localized custom.
Let me ask you, or rather let me make a comment myself. Every caller, ever since I've addressed this subject, who is a Muslim, goes on to deny it. But there are 140 million women who are mutilated. Wouldn't it be more human, more compassionate, if you were to stand up against the practice, even if it's not practiced in Pakistan, but for example, in Indonesia, among Muslims?
I'm with you. I'm glad that you have the courage to speak against it. But hopefully you will also make a distinction that it's also a local custom. And,
it seems to me, though, sir, you might argue that if it's a local custom, it's a local custom which is accepted in the Islamic context as it would not be accepted in the context of other religious systems.
No. Certain Islamic countries are practicing it.
Yeah.
Not all of them.
But so no Christian countries, and nor is Israel practicing it. I think that point is quite simplistic, but should be made.
It's not mentioned in Quran.
Yeah, we understand that. We thank you, sir, for the call. And we go quickly to another. 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. Hi, I've really, really enjoyed the discussion, and I appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to looking into the book. And my comment is, Americans in general are very uneducated, in my opinion, on Islam. In your opinion, do you think it's important, how important do you think it is for the average American to understand? And if so, what do you think is the best way for people to get this information, knowing that we trust the media, well, kind of trust the media, and knowing also that it's a very uncomfortable subject because we don't really want to upset anybody?
I think that the average American, first and foremost, must make a distinction between Judaism and Christianity on the one hand and Islam on the other hand. Judaism and Christianity have gone through a process of reformation, a process of enlightenment, self-reflection, and so on, and have accepted secular law. Islam is going through that process as we speak, hasn't gone through that process yet. So that's what the average American should know. Where do you get your information from? Average Americans are citizens of an open, liberal society. They are free men and women, and if they feel that one medium is not providing them with accurate information, then they can turn to another medium and they can educate themselves on that. There is a lot of information in the United States and people have access to that. And I think that it's not excusable to say, I will get my information only from one source of media. I'm being a little harsh there perhaps, but the average American does not find himself or herself in the same position as, say, people in Saudi Arabia and Egypt do, who are dependent on only state information.
Okay. No, thank you.
Thank you, sir,
You're
for
welcome.
The call.
Yeah.
And quickly to another, 591-7200. And let me repeat the invitation for any and all to reach us via email, if that's the modality you choose. The email address, extension720, as one word, extension720@tribune.com. TRIBUNE.com. And for phones, of course, 591-7200, the area code 312 if you're calling long distance, and on to another caller. Hello, you're on the air. Are you there?
Yeah, is it me you're talking to?
Somebody who imitates you very well.
Okay. Well, Ms. Ali, I first of all, let me congratulate you on really having the courage and the guts to speak out on the media, which is so well heard of in Chicagoland area. And you have done a wonderful job in writing this novel. And just about half an hour ago, my daughter was with me in the car. We both were listening very intently to what you said. And she wanted to ask you a question. Let me ask her on her behalf. What she wanted to know was that have you ever tried to talk to any of the progressive mullahs and the fathers of the religion, I would say, Muslim religion, and in support of what you have written, and what has the response been?
I have, living in Holland, made an attempt to speak to the imams there.
Mm-hmm.
There was also an attempt made by a friend of mine to bring me together with Imam Abu Laban, who was in Denmark, who took the cartoons to the Middle East to create the whole commotion around that. But they would not speak to me because they would label me an infidel, an apostate, and they would say, we don't want to talk to you. And as long as that is the case, then I think you cannot have a dialogue on your own.
Do you, sir, know any particular imams who are in the category that you describe?
No, I'm afraid not, because I'm not a Muslim really, but I've stayed in a Muslim country for about 7 years, and I find the religion to be beautiful. It's just the way that the men folk in this religion, such a beautiful religion, interpret this religion to their own means and their own gains, which I object to very strongly. And I agree with you 100% that women are not treated at par in the Muslim religion, and that should change, and that should change very quickly.
Do I gather correctly that you are a Hindu in background?
That's correct. I'm a Hindu from India. And but as I said before, it's a beautiful religion. I have had the occasion of reading this religion a little bit and following its customs. And it's just that it's been misrepresented by a few people for their own ways and means. I have another question very quickly. When is your movie coming out, or has it already come out, Submission?
No, Submission Part 2 has not come out. It's in the making. I cannot give you a date because it's not ready yet.
But the first Submission,
what about Part 1?
Which is only a 10-minute film.
Yes.
It's probably available on the Internet.
It is available, but the production company does not want to provide it, and say for security reasons, mm-hmm. they don't want to have it aired. But it's on the Internet. And yeah. Some people,
is it available in America?
On the Internet, you can download it at your risk.
I can download it? Okay. Yes. Is there any site that I could go to?
Just Google it. I'm sure you'll find it.
Well, Ms. Ali, it's a pleasure hearing you.
Thank you very much.
I'm in my car. I'm in my garage, and I'm still not getting out of my car.
We thank you, sir, for the call.
Don't want to miss this.
Thank
right.
you very much.
Good night.
Okay.
And directly to another 591-7200. Good evening.
Hello, Dr. Rosenberg.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for a very fascinating program. I would like to respectfully suggest to Ms. Ali that perhaps reasoning alone is not sufficient to present her ideas, which are contrary to some very basic religious beliefs. And I'm wondering in what way she could present these ideas to young Muslims in the West that would have the power of the imams and the Quran.
Thank you, ma'am, for asking me this question. And precisely what you point out is what my publishers, my literary agents, my friends, journalists have pointed out and said. Research alone and the gathering of facts alone is not going to convince. It's going to convince very few people. Write your life story, and that way you relate to people who have gone through or comparably through the same circumstances. That is why I've written the book Infidel. So that's one way of going about it. I've suggested it's. I can't do everything all on my own, but I have suggested to the cinema world to make more submissions, to make something like The Life of Brian, but then The Life of Mohammed. So there are many, many ways of appealing and teaching and educating and challenging young minds. But I can't, of course, do them all. I can only take advantage of the platforms that I get and suggest them.
The risks are sometimes high. I do think, again, of Salman Rushdie, who got into that trouble and got the Ayatollah Khomeini ready to have him killed by virtue of his doing something, a surreal chapter or two in his book, Satanic Verses, in which he actually is just representing a dream that one of the characters has about Muhammad. And that was enough to be viewed as deeply sacrilegious and to put out the hit order on Salman Rushdie. And Rushdie was also guarded and was around the world for a while. He dropped in here one night, as I said, unannounced, and they asked us not even to tell the audience in advance that he was coming. But then a few years later, he announced his reinvestment in Islam, as if he had been reconverted. And that was viewed cynically by some people as an attempt to placate them and get them off his back, though it didn't work.
I think that Salman Rushdie is a very, very brave man.
He is indeed.
And I think he has done enough. He has done what he could. He made his contribution, and I admire him extremely well. And because he went through what he went through, people like me may have fatwas against us that are informal, but not state fatwas. So that's in itself an achievement.
The British government got the government of Iran, after the death of the Ayatollah, to withdraw the fatwa. But there were individual rich Muslims elsewhere in the Arab world who have certified that they are still ready to pay the full reward for anybody who kills Rushdie.
Yes, but that's all clandestine, and that makes them into criminals. And today, as the United States is cracking down on financial,
one would hope so.
Yeah. Money coming from wealthy people in the Middle East and going to terrorist activities, that they're going to have a hard time doing that. But what Rushdie did was open the way for people like me and Irshad Manji and the others and say, okay, now you go ahead. And I'll also just do my bit and at one point also turn back to just living. So
I do hope you can.
Yeah.
Let me read you an email that I've got here. Thank you for a very important program. Two questions, please. What constituency elected Ms. Hirsi Ali to office in the Netherlands, and how did they respond to her public career? Could she have been re-elected? By whom?
We have a proportional system in the Netherlands. It's a one-district system. We don't have constituencies. We have a list system. The Liberal Party put me on the list on position 16, which was electable. And yes, I would have been re-elected if I stood for office, but I did not want to stand for office again because I felt in 2004 that I had accomplished what I set out to do, and that was to create awareness for the position, deplorable position of Muslim women, and to point out that cultural variables were far more important in determining whether an immigrant got assimilated or integrated well or not.
A second question from the same listener. And what are her thoughts on the, quote, Muslim vote in Europe, if there is one?
Yes, there is a Muslim vote. That's very, very worrying. We have seen it in the local elections in the Netherlands, where large numbers of Muslims are in the four big cities. And that really, anything that the national government had been trying to do to fight against the growing Islamism was frustrated when it came to the local elections, because then the largest number of voters are Muslims who do not want to change. And you see that in countries like France and the UK. And so, yes, the Muslim vote matters. And as the demographics change, it's going to matter only more and more. So in that sense, whoever asked the question has a point.
How in the world did you manage to acquire a Dutch well enough to serve in the parliament? You didn't know a word of it when you arrived there, did you?
No, I didn't know a word. I didn't have anything to lose to start with. And fortunately, I'm better at languages than at math and at counting.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't learn a language by going to school. You learn a language by interacting with the people who speak it, the natives, and I got many, many friends with whom I could speak and practice Dutch.
We go back to the phones now, 591-7200. Good evening.
Good evening, and thank you for taking my call, and it's a real pleasure to talk to you. And some commentators in the West have been referring to Islamic extremists as Islamofascists. What is your take on that term? Is that an accurate term, Islamofascists?
I feel that it is. Because that will take us back to what fascism is, dividing the world into we and they, the longing for a utopia, making the individual human being subordinate to the collective, assigning women and gays a position that they're either very subordinate or killed, and then this systematic anti-Semitism or Jewish hatred. It all fits into what the fascism that we had seen during the 1930s and 40s in Germany and in Italy. So using the term Islamofascism, I would say, is more accurate than just saying we are waging a war against terrorism. Terrorism is just a tactic, and that doesn't tell us much.
But don't corporations have to be involved in some way in tandem with the state for fascism to apply?
Well, they are in the Middle East. I mean, Saudi Arabia is paying for the ideology, and it is a state. Iran is doing the same. Afghanistan, Pakistan, I'm sorry, but there are very many states involved in the spread of this particular fascist ideology. It's just that in the West, it's either coming in slowly and people are being persuaded to, or being frightened and intimidated into accepting or accommodating or appeasing Islamofascist practices.
Well, thank you very much.
You're
we thank you, sir, for the call. Do you know what you're doing tomorrow night at 7 o'clock? No, I do.
You do?
You're speaking at the Winnetka Community House
okay.
up in Winnetka, Illinois.
I'm looking forward to that.
7 p.m. tomorrow night.
Yes.
And we are going to return to the phones. We now have a few lines available at last, so if you've been trying to reach us, do make another quick try. 591-7200. And here's another email. Next August, my daughter and son-in-law will leave to teach at the American International School in the capital of Saudi Arabia. Can you speculate as to what life will be like for them there?
They'll certainly be confronted with a world that is very different from theirs.
You've lived in Saudi Arabia as well.
I've lived in Saudi Arabia. I've lived in Jeddah, Mecca, and Riyadh.
Mm.
And they will be, they'll be faced with the segregation of the sexes. Men and women do not mix in Saudi Arabia. Your daughter will be forced to veil or will be obligated to veil.
A Western woman is forced to do that?
Yes, a Western woman too. If you're in Saudi Arabia, as a woman, you have to veil.
A veil in the sense of a headscarf or covering the face as well?
I think that, I don't know, they've probably become milder in some places, but at the time when we lived there, everyone had to veil and cover their faces as well.
Mm.
My mother would not cover her face. Not always. And that is probably an individual prerogative. You have to wait for the police for the virtue who ensure virtue and who fight against vice to come and see and determine what to do with you. But I would say to any Americans who go to Saudi Arabia, please ask the Saudis if you can have a Bible, if you can build a church there, if you can practice your culture there, pretty much as many Muslims demand in Western countries that they can practice their religion and their culture.
No churches are allowed there at all.
No churches, no synagogues. Even Shias are called heretics.
Yeah.
So even Muslims who are moderate are discriminated against. And this is a country that in international fora again and again demands some special Islamic human rights. And people in the West, Muslims in the West, complaining of Islamophobia.
Mm-hmm.
I would say, what about all those people in the rest, in Muslim countries, who cannot have their own temples or churches or synagogues, or people like me who leave the religion, what happens to them? That's the question that we should be asking Muslims again and again every time they raise the matter of Islamophobia.
We are due for an update on the news, and for that, to the newsroom and Paula Cooper. The book by our guest tonight, by Ayan Hirsi Ali, is titled simply, Strongly Infidel, and it is published by Free Press. Here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Good evening. First of all, I'd have to say how much I admire your guest tonight for what she's doing to bring intelligence and justice to the world. My question that I wanted to bring up is actually inspired by a book review I read from the January 19th Times Literary Supplement about a book called The God Delusion. It's and the reviewer points out that although science was at its greatest, the greatest in the world was in the Baghdad, the House of Wisdom, in the 9th century. After the 12th century, after so many accomplishments were made by Islamic scientists, the support for science among the leaders of the Islamic world seemed to go down, and as a result, we haven't seen very much science since then. I was just wondering if this might be connected to the strength of the religious fundamentalism, the lack of support for science, and all the what it does for people.
Well, it is commonly claimed that in earlier centuries, Islam achieved a great deal in science, in mathematics
right.
particularly, and also what is commonly claimed is that Islam was the key to saving the works of classical antiquity, particularly the Greek philosophers.
Aristotle and the zero,
yeah,
inventing the zero, or Arabs did that. Like all religions, there's always been a tension between those who want those who are curious, rational, and want to discover the world around them, and those who say there are limits to curiosity, and the limit is when it puts questions to God or the story, the divine story, then you should stop. And in Islam, that tension has never been resolved. Always those who wanted to look and investigate the world around them, who had scientific minds, got killed or shunned or frustrated in some way, and many of them, or some of many of them, left their countries. If you look at the brilliant Turkish or Iranian or Pakistani scientists, they live in the United States or in the UK. They don't live in their countries of origin because that's not appreciated. And the Prophet Muhammad himself said, all knowledge is in the Quran, and what's beyond that is no longer knowledge. So, and that's what, unfortunately, all Muslim children are taught by their parents. You will find knowledge and the highest form of knowledge in the Quran. And this stunts curiosity. And this is unfortunate. And that's why I think one of the tragedies of multiculturalism is when Muslims come to the West, they are allowed to have their own little enclaves, self-segregate, and continue to stunt this curiosity and rationalism, even when there's no need to it, even in islands of knowledge.
Ayan, have you ever tried to examine the similarities and the differences between two fundamentalisms, the Islam that you have talked about tonight and fundamentalist Christianity?
I was in the Netherlands for 14 years, and Christian fundamentalists in the Netherlands, well, to start with, they did not have a political philosophy. They do not have a following. They are not violent. And even when within families, there is tension between parents and children, those who want to stay within the faith and those who want to leave, that all occurs peacefully. What I've learned that is going on in the United States is, for example, the need to introduce creationism in the science class. That sort of fundamentalism I find to be incredibly dangerous, because that means you're going to groom, you're going to raise children who have not been able to develop their critical faculties. And then you create a society of fundamentalists. So that development I find to be dangerous. But if I compare Islam as it's practiced today and Christianity as it's practiced today, I would say it is not, it would be foolish to confuse the two.
I had forgotten earlier to note something that I want to make instantly clear to all who are listening. On our own blog, miltsfile.com, miltsfile.com gets you there instantly, where we put up various articles two or three times a week, things that interest me and that are sometimes quite related to the program. We have this as the first item tonight after the one that describes the program that we are now doing. I read, this excellent article about tonight's guest appeared last week in the UK Observer newspaper and would be a useful and instructive supplement to our discussion with Ayan Hirsi Ali. And that, when you click to it, is titled Taking the Fight to Islam by Andrew Anthony in the Observer of Sunday, February 4th. A fascinating article, very well done, I think. Were you pleased by it? I thought it had a good deal of useful content.
Absolutely, and I'm most pleased by the title. I'm almost never pleased by headings, but this one I am. Taking the debate to Islam, that is where it is. We are not, we are not at war with terrorism. There is a conflict between Islam as a philosophy, as a body of ideas, and as a political movement, and the West, and especially liberalism as a body of ideas.
But surely you recognize that Islam has a future. It has a future as long into the future as humankind. It won't disappear as a religion, nor do you. You don't want it to disappear, do you?
No, I don't want, and really I don't, that's not, for me it's not relevant whether it stays or whether it, I care about Muslims. And as long as Muslims allow themselves to be persuaded that the values of the Enlightenment are much better and provide a better method of living together than the political philosophy of Islam, then I'm pleased. And maybe Islam, like communism, became social democracy, or part of it could be, you know, evolve into social democracy.
Exactly.
Maybe Islam can evolve into some enlightened form. I've seen the Ismailis, the Ahmadiyyas. There are little groups of Muslims who have made out of Islam something that is compatible with humanity.
There is a movement abroad. I mentioned it to you before we came on the air. One of the leading people in it is an old friend of mine. He's a Syrian philosopher, Sadek al-Azm, which is a movement of Islamic academics, basically, and other professional people who are certainly also interested in reform and the modernization of the faith.
Yes, and I've also talked to Sheikh Kabani, who's a Sufi man, and who says we have, first and foremost, let's separate the realm of religion from the realm of politics. And that, as I mean, if Muslims succeed in that, if Muslims come to value human life as an end in itself and accept that you cannot impose your religion on someone else, accept the equality of men and women, of gays and heterosexuals, then I don't really care very much what that privatized sort of Islam becomes.
One constant, I think, that can be given virtually as a law is that all religions always change, just as all human institutions always change. If you look at the history of Christianity or Judaism or Hinduism or Buddhism or Islam, one notes patterns of transformation.
Yes.
And obviously, in a way, what is involved is a continuing struggle for the heart of Islam, I should think.
Yes.
And a struggle that will go on for centuries to come.
And I hope a struggle that will be as bloodless as possible.
Well, to be sure.
It's wishful thinking.
All struggles should be bloodless, but they're not.
No.
We pause a last round of commercials, then directly back to the phones. Our guest tonight has been, and for the next 8 minutes continues to be, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, the book that is the occasion for our getting together, just published in this country, Infidel, and the publisher's Free Press, 591-7200. You are next on the air. Good evening.
Well, Milt?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, my question is for both you and your guest. I want to know if you can identify what the turning point was, say, in the last 10, 15 years that brought all of these Islamic extremists out of the woodwork. For example, does it have to do with the end of the Persian Gulf War or with Osama bin Laden? Or I'll give you another thing. I was in Europe traveling in 1989 when I got out of college, and I was actually in Berlin a week before the wall came down. And, you know, we saw all these countries breaking free from Russia and everything. And Europeans that we met, everyone was just so excited. It was a terrific time. Everyone was so optimistic about the future and about the 21st century coming up that, you know, maybe there wouldn't be wars and problems and stuff. And
Francis Fukuyama announced the end of history.
And then all of a sudden, you know, came 9/11, and of course we were all horrified, and here we go again. So I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Yes, an interesting question indeed.
I think that 1989 is perhaps a crucial year. That is when the Berlin Wall came down, and when the Soviet Union and communism was defeated and had become self-defeating. There were scholars like, and are scholars like Bernard Lewis, like Samuel Huntington, a journalist called David Price Jones in the UK, who had predicted that radical Islamism was going to take the place of communism.
I can't resist, all three of those people have been on this program talking about these matters.
Yes. And they had been declared, you know, crazy people. They were exaggerating. They were alarmists. They were ignored. And often I think I wish we had listened to them when the problem was small and when we could have contained it.
Our thanks to that caller, and we'll go quickly to another. Good evening. You are on the air.
Okay, you know, it seems to me Muslim women in Western countries, the burqa presents a major problem. If a woman has any type of, like, head covering on, if you're dealing with her, a lot of her nonverbal responses are kind of masked. And so you don't have the same sense like you know where the woman's at or you know what's going on. So you feel kind of isolated from it. And secondly, it kind of marks her off as almost like the property of a Muslim community. And you don't know, you better be careful. I mean, I can't really
You've been wandering Devon Avenue in Chicago, I would bet.
Yeah. I can't imagine a young guy just sort of asking a woman with a burqa out, so she doesn't get those opportunities, or so it would seem to me.
Well, she's not supposed to. That's
well,
the whole
point. That's the whole
well,
point.
What I'm getting is I think the burqa may be a major point here.
I think that the burqa is not the point. The burqa is a symptom of a sexual morality that finds its roots within Islam, and that is the male or the man is incapable of sexual self-restraint. Therefore, the woman must cover her body and her seductive parts. Preferably, she should stay at home, but if there is some pressing need for her to go outside, then she must cover herself. And the covering of the self is to prevent men from asking her, at least to discourage them from asking her out. When I see women on the streets wearing burqas, and I understand this morality, a woman who's covered is demonstrating to me as an uncovered woman that I am a whore, and to every male on the street that he's a potential rapist. So it's not the burqa that's the problem, it's the morality, and it's that we have to discuss.
But don't you see, if she wears the burqa, she doesn't get the choice. You know, no one's going to relate to her in the same way. If that sort of became like just like not the thing to do in Western societies, or frankly, if we kind of like, you know, poo-pooed it, women would get some opportunities to change, or so I would think.
Yes, and the great struggle in the 21st century for Muslim women will be getting an opportunity to finish their school, becoming financially independent, and getting control over their own bodies and over their own sexuality, in which case the burqa will be redundant.
Our thanks to the caller. We're almost out of time, of course. Just another minute or two. How do you sustain yourself? You're living a high-tension life, there's a high burden that you're carrying. Not merely the danger of injury, but you run into a lot of hostility, I know.
Well, we've talked tonight about Salman Rushdie.
Yeah.
And like he at one point decided, well, I've done enough, I'm going to do other things,
mm-hmm.
I'm also going to do the same. I think that I have I've presented my message, I've done it again and again, repeated it, loud and clear, and then there comes a moment when I'm going to choose for my own private individual happiness, and I'd like to start that any moment.
You'd have to change your identity.
Oh, not necessarily.
I mean, they know who you are.
Oh, no, it's like relay. I'll just give pass the stick on to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to say that there are more and more young women and young men who are standing up from within the Muslim world and from the West who wants to take it on. So I don't have the sense of desolation and loneliness that I had in 2002, 2003,
mm-hmm.
when I thought I was the only one out there.
Well, you're with a good outfit right now, AEI in Washington. I know a number of people there.
Yes.
And there's some very interesting scholars there, and there's a nice general community attitude or atmosphere there. But what are you going to be working on? You're working there as a scholar. This book is finished. What will you be doing next?
The next book is on the Prophet Muhammad waking up in the New York Public Library and meeting three of my favorite Western philosophers, John Stuart Mill, with whom he will discuss the position of women, Friedrich Hayek, with whom he will discuss the relationship between the individual and the collective, and Karl Popper, with whom he will discuss the open society and its enemies, and all that in New York and in a library. And that sort of life consists only of reading and writing. So it's very, very quiet.
So you're going to be imagining that dialogue?
Yes.
Or those dialogues.
Yes.
That sounds like a fascinating thing.
Thank you.
I look forward to your doing it and publishing it and coming back and talking with us about it.
I'm looking forward to coming and doing that here.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali has been our guest. Again, the title of that book is Infidel.